You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 478. Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no. John Belushi.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have filmmaker RJ Cutler. And RJ is not only a narrative filmmaker, but he's also a very, very accomplished documentary and nonfiction director as well. He has worked on films like the Oscar-nominated The War Room, A Perfect Candidate, The September Issue, The World According to Dick Cheney, If I Stay, Belushi, and the brand new film, Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry for Apple TV. And he's also one of the co-creators of the hit television series, Nashville. RJ and I had a fantastic conversation. It truly is a masterclass in storytelling. I love the way RJ tells his stories in documentary as well as narrative film. And his new documentary, Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry, is fantastic. I knew very little about Billie Eilish before I saw this. Of course, my daughters knew a lot about her, but I did not. And I was fascinated by this artist's journey, and RJ was able to capture that in this documentary. So we're going to talk a bunch about that, as well as his process and all the other films that he's worked on in his career. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with RJ Cutler. I'd like to welcome to the show RJ Cutler. How you doing, RJ?
I'm all right. Thank you very much. All is good.
Very cool. I love your mic. It's much more impressive than mine, so I I appreciate the audio quality.
Well, you know, mic envy is a easily addressed issue.
I won't feel too bad about it.
Amazon can take care of that.
That's very true.
Two clicks
and it's done. Exactly. So I wanted to ask you, let's just jump into it. How did you get started in the business?
I mean, it depends on how thorough an answer you want, but I started directing plays. I think I was in first grade, and I was forcing my classmates to do adaptations of Charlie Brown books on the school the baseball field outside of my elementary school, and then we'd invite the whole school to come join in. And you know, I was just a kid who liked to put on plays and also loved journalism, and I pursued a career, or had a career really, as a young theater director. It's what I studied at school, and for 8-9 years in New York, I directed. I was James Lapine's assistant director on the original production of Into the Woods. I did the original productions of Secret Garden, 2 productions before it went to Broadway and ran for several seasons. I had this wonderful life in the theater, but I always kind of, in the back of my mind, somehow thought that I would combine that passion with my equal passion in journalism, or mm-hmm. or, you know, curiosity about world events, which is just something I always had. And then in the summer of 1992, I had this idea to make a documentary about Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, which was heading towards the election. And I partnered with a dear friend of mine, Wendy Ettinger, and we pursued that idea, found our way to the brownstone of D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus and Fraser Pennebaker, the legendary documentary filmmakers, and pitch them this idea. And, you know, as I say, there are long stories and short stories, but the short story is I produced The War Room. That was my first film. And it was not only a fantastic experience and a great success. We were nominated for an Oscar and had an incredible time and witnessed the campaign from within it, and introduced the world to James Carville and George Stephanopoulos. And but I along the way received this incredible education in documentary filmmaking and cinema verite filmmaking from at the feet of the masters, you know, D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus, who were so incredibly supportive of me and generous with their time. And I literally would sit next to Chris as she was editing on the Steenbeck and ask her questions. And Penny, who was a great teacher and philosopher of verite, was always sharing lessons. And that's how I got started, you know. Yeah, since then, I've been, you know, that's 1992, so we're nearing 30 years of doing this. Yeah.
So yeah, you've done a couple things since then, without question. Now, The War Room specifically, there is a visceral energy in that film. Mm. I mean, you can sense it coming off. I mean, that must have been insane, just being in that room, that energy. I mean, it's been 30 years, so I was a younger man back then, to say the least. But I remember the excitement around Bill Clinton and around.
Oh, it was crazy.
I mean, it was just this thing.
Yeah, they were rock stars. He and Al Gore, they were young men. Were they 40? If they were, they were barely 40, and they had these young wives and all these young people around them. And Pennebaker, who had done a great deal of filming with Bobby and Jack Kennedy in their prime, during their rise to power and until both of their deaths, he said that it hadn't been since then that he had experienced anything like this. He recognized immediately in the Clinton campaign that kind of youthful energy and vigor and vitality and passion and certainty that this group could change the world. And you felt it. You sure did feel it, man. It was you really felt it, you know. And when you talk about that, it's something that the film was able to capture so beautifully. Yeah.
And Carvel, you central casting couldn't have sent him. I mean, it's
they couldn't have, and they did. And, you know, we had to Penny, first thing Penny said about James, I remember after the first day or two of filming, we were like, well, maybe we make a film about him. And Penny was like, well, I don't know. He's kind of like the drunken uncle who won't leave the party. But then we got the film processed and we put it up. And I remember clear as day, Penny watching it and saying, that guy's a movie star. Mm-hmm. That's a movie. We can make a movie about him. Mm-hmm. And he was right. And he was right, because we thought, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know what I was doing. And I was like, well, we'll follow these two guys, because the first time I mentioned to Penny and Chris that, you know, that I was like, I got access. I did it. I pulled it off. I got us in. We're in the campaign. And they said, well, when do we start shooting with Governor Clinton? And I was like, well, not Governor Clinton, but the guys who are running the campaign, what are we going to do with them? I was like, maybe, you know, they'll take us to Bill Clinton, and then when they leave, we'll stay. And I didn't quite know that that's not the way it works. The whole film, we thought we were making a film about Bill Clinton, and one day I remember being disappointed. I remember on election night, we never quite got to be with Clinton. We filmed his speech to the world, and we were with James and George, and he hugged them, and we filmed that. But then the camera ran out of film, we couldn't go. And I remember sitting in a cloakroom in the governor's mansion, waiting to get access to finally be with Clinton on election night, and just not getting it. And into the cloakroom came Al Gore's daughters, and they were waiting, and we were all just kind of waiting, you know. And they got brought into the party, of course, but we didn't. But as everything was on that film, that was a great lesson in the fact that you know, you don't always know what you have till you look at what you have. And when we looked at what we have, especially in the hands of as brilliant editors as Penny and Chris, who could bring it to life and bring the humor to life and bring the characters to life. I mean, man, they used every frame we shot on that film, every frame, but they made a masterful film.
It was absolutely a masterful film. Now, as a documentarian, how do you bring out the truth of your subject, the subject that you're shooting? Because, human beings generally have a veneer, a wall sometimes a wall with guns aimed at you to protect themselves.
Right. Sure.
So a documentarian, sometimes they'll agree to do a piece, but that doesn't mean that they're allowing you in yet. So how do you kind of bring the truth out of a subject?
What a great question. And really, to be honest, the only question there is about the work that we do. And the answer is you earn their trust. You earn their trust. And you earn their trust by, being trustworthy. there's a common misnomer, which is that we're flies on the wall. And that's our goal, is to be a fly on the wall and to vanish into the woodwork. That's another one. Mm-hmm. And to disappear so you don't even know we're there. None of those things are our actual objective. I can't be a fly on the wall. I mean, I'm 6'1". I got some presents to me. Mm-hmm. My camera person has a camera with them. My sound person has a boom. We're people in a room. There are only a few of us, and we're not hanging lights, and we're good at getting out of your way, but we're human beings. And the key is for us as human beings to have a relationship with you as a human being, you the subject. And if we have a relationship with you wherein you're as comfortable being yourself with us as you are with anybody with whom you trust and are fully comfortable being yourself, then we can capture that on film. And that's all we aim for. We want to earn your trust, you know, on Monday. And if we do, we know that we still have to earn it on Tuesday, and we still have to earn it on Wednesday. And as I say, the way to earn people's trust is to be trustworthy. The way you earn their trust in any relationship, you have to be who you say you are. You can't say, hey, there are only three of us and we never use lights or heavy equipment or any cables. And and I always like to leave 10 minutes before you ask me to leave. That's my approach, and trust, you know, you'll trust us, and that's how we'll make it. You can't say that and then show up with 30 people, lights, cables, trucks, and refuse to leave until you get it. You know, you gotta be who you say you are. And, you know, who we say we are people who are there to observe. We just want to see life. We want to see how it happens. How if you're Billie Eilish, how you're handling all the things that are going on, and how you're living your life, and how you're writing your album with your brother, and what that's all about. And we're simply there to see that. I don't want anything else. You know, people ask me, Would the film have not worked if she didn't win the Grammys? I don't care if she wins the Grammys. I don't care if she sells a single album. I'm there to tell the story of a remarkable young artist coming of age and a remarkable young woman coming of age. And that story, however that story unfolds, is the story I want to tell. I don't want anything else. I just want to see clearly, and then I want to be able to tell the story truthfully, as you said.
No, and what's remarkable about your career is the subject matters that you've taken on. You know, some of obviously have been of great, you know, legendary people like Jim Belushi who have passed. But a lot of Jim.
Jim's still with us.
Jim is still with us.
Harvesting the cannabis.
Yes, he is.
On behalf of us all.
Yes, he is. So, I mean, so you do subject matters like that, and that's a different kind of documentarian work as opposed to, you know, Dick Cheney or the head of Vogue or Billy. These are very big presence, you know, these are big people present, you know, very have heavy presence. They're shadows, especially like Dick Cheney and I forgot her name, the head of Vogue.
Anna Wintour.
Anna, yes. Having, you know, the shadow that walks in with them on the door is massive. The trust that they must have to open themselves up, because I've seen those films and they're just, I mean, they open themselves up. And you're right, there needs to be a trust. And obviously your track record does open some doors as well. But at a certain point, I don't care if you won an Oscar or you didn't win an Oscar or whoever you've worked with. At a certain point, it's just you and me. I'm here. And it's a camera. I don't care who you are or what you are, but I have to trust you. And that's the human aspect of it, regardless of how do you cut through all the celebrity and all of the other stuff that is thrown upon these souls, if you will, and just get to them.
I mean, it's there are a number of ways of answering that. One is that what connects the subject to the process is their desire to have their story told. And that transcends. When we're sitting there, it's two human beings. Well, one of those human beings wants to have their story told, and the other human being wants to tell their story. So we're actually very much in harmony. And I'm there with you, man. I get it. I know. I don't know why you want to have your story told. I don't mean to say I don't think you should. I mean to say I don't ask why. That's on you. And I trust you that you want to have your story told. It's a very human desire, and I'm connecting with you on that level. And to be honest, that's really fundamentally it. That's what draws me to you. And then there are other things that I'm an empathic person. I'm a curious person. I'm present. I'm well trained by by D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hedges and all my experiences.
Sure.
I'm trustworthy because I know that, I want it these days. I can say to somebody, feel free to call anyone I've worked with and you'll see. But, fortunately the work, is there and stands for itself. But that's really what connects us. And that, I know that we're all our parents' children. We're all the little boys and girls that we were one day long ago. I know that it hasn't been all that long since then, no matter how old we are. And I know that one day is, that we're all dust in the wind. And so celebrity doesn't, I've made plenty of projects that aren't about celebrities. I made films about high school kids and college kids and young physicians and young men and women in the military. And those projects are every bit as rich as the celebrity driven projects, but it's not celebrity that is as interesting, even though it of course has been a subject. It's a subject in the Billy film. It's a subject in the Belushi film. There's no question. But what drives my curiosity are people who are, who are great at what they do and care a tremendous amount about it and are doing it as well as they possibly can under high stakes circumstances. I'm, you know, I'm, I'm, I, as I mentioned, I come from the theater. I want to put on a good show and I want to spin a great yarn and I want you to laugh and cry and stomp your feet and cheer when it's over. I, you know, and leave the theater grateful that you devoted, you know, that you gave up your time to be there. And I want to have earned that gratitude. You know, I want to have spent your time well. You're putting your trust in me too. So, those are my goals.
Now, with those first few projects, like the War Room and the projects, like a few projects after that, what were the biggest lessons you learned? Because you were brand new to this medium. You know, what was the biggest lesson you took away from, let's say, the War Room? Because that was such a, I mean, you were surrounded by such amazing, you know, collaborators. Sure. What was that one lesson you're like, oh, this is the thing I'm taking away, one of the big things I'm taking away from this process?
It really is that you have to trust in the process, that the principles reveal themselves, or that they work out, and that the things, the characters reveal themselves. The if you stick very early on, I mean, the different things Penny said to me that I think about every day. You know, one of the very first things he said to me was, you know, if you want to do this kind of work, you better have a bank robber's mentality, travel light, and be ready to make a break for it at any moment. And you know, I didn't know what he meant, but I know now. and that you gotta, you know, you gotta be light on your feet. You gotta be able to adjust. You gotta make it if necessary. You gotta make a break for it. You know, you gotta. But he also said, you know, the first thing he does when he used to do when he walked into a room, into a shooting environment, was find a table to sit down next to and take his camera apart and clean it. Because he wanted the people who he was filming to know that he was a guy with a job too. He's no different than them. He's not a body with a camera on its head. You know, he's a human being who's there to connect with you on a human level. There's so many of those lessons. One of the kind of lessons that I share with others that to me is the in a way, the kind of lesson of how to approach this kind of filmmaking came to me from Wayne Gretzky, the great hockey player, mm-hmm. who never gave interviews. But one day I remember watching an interview with him between periods. Somehow they got a hold of him and the announcer, the interviewer said, tell us, great one. What is your secret? How do you do it? Tell us, please tell us. And Gretzky said, well, it's quite simple. I just follow the puck. And I remember thinking, oh my God, everybody else on the hockey rink is trying to get the puck to do what they want it to do. But there's Gretzky somehow communing with the puck and letting it lead him. Well, that sounds odd, but it's the key, was the key to his success. And I think it's the key to the success that I have in doing this, in that I'm following life. I'm not asking life to do something. I'm not trying to force it. I'm not trying to force the puck into the net. I'm just following the puck, man, because it's on a beautiful journey. And if it ends up in that goal, even, you know, so much the better.
Oh, that's, yeah. And that's one of the most amazing quotes in sports history, but I think in his industry in general. I think it was like, he follows the puck and he also likes to be where the puck is going to be. And I think
that's
as a document,
right. That's right. All of those things, yeah. All of those things, you know, Penny, another thing I wish, you know, we could talk for an hour, just me remembering different things Pennebaker said to me at different times. True. But one of the things he said was that, directing is what happens. You don't direct while you're in the field. You're not telling, I'm not saying put it over there, put the camera over there, frame it up. That's not directing. Directing, he said, is what happens in the bar at the end of the day. And what he meant by that was that after the shoot, you sit around and you say to each other, what did you see? What did you hear? What was your experience of the day? What moved you? What questions did you have? And as long as everybody is communicating about those things, you're ready for the next day and you move along. Another thing Penny said, I remember wrapping the War Room and I had been out at some event and I had met Pat Riley, who at the time was the Knicks coach.
Yeah.
And And he had seen The War Room. It was out. The film was out. So we mm-hmm. were in our kind of like, you know, we were going to parties and, you know, people knew that I had produced the film and someone introduced me to Pat Riley and we had this great chat. And I said, you know, we should make a film about you. And he was like, oh, you know, he was not uninterested. Mm-hmm. And that was enough for me. And the next day I saw Penny and I said to him, I think I found our next film. I'll produce and you guys will direct and we'll tell the story of Pat Riley, one of the greatest coaches to ever be in all of sports. And he's right here in town down the road at Madison Square Garden. And Penny said, I thought you wanted to be a director. And I was like, I do, but look, another project's fell into our lap and I love producing and this has been great. And you guys are the director. He's like, no. You want to be a director. You find a film to direct. Because you're not a director until you wake up in the middle of the night screaming. And you don't wake up in the middle of the night screaming when you're producing a film, only when you're directing it. And and I was like, wow, it was generous, yeah. Truthful. And a month or so later, I was at a college reunion and I ran into my old friend, David Van Taylor, who's one of a brilliant documentarian. And he and I started kibitzing about, different stories that people would tell. And he said to me, you know, if you really want to tell a story about America and American politics, Oliver North is going to run. Iran-Contra Ali is going to run for Senate. And we should tell that story. And I said, I'll do it if you'll do it. And off we went. We directed a film together. And I love that film. It's called A Perfect Candidate. It's really, I'm so proud of it. It's mm-hmm. it's if The War Room is a celebration of the kind of joy of American politics, the A Perfect Candidate is its dark underbelly, just filthy, nasty, just unbelievable. Like, I can't believe it. And we got it. We were there. We were inside it. And man, did I wake up screaming in the middle of the night, like more times than I wish to remember. But I learned what directing was, what directing one of these films was. And, you know, you're dealing with powerful stuff. It's you're harnessing the, you know, you're in the you're being given an opportunity by the gods to harvest that power and tell the stories of human life. And it's intense stuff. So, you know, now sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, I don't have to scream because I've been through it before, but Penny was right. You haven't directed one of these films until you've woken up in the middle of the night screaming.
And now you wake up in a cold sweat. You don't scream, but there might be a cold sweat.
Fortunately, my wife here isn't. My wife isn't here to refute your observation. But let's let it stand.
Fair enough. Now, you did this great documentary on. One of my favorite comedians of all time, John Belushi, and I mean his story is remarkable. When you go down the rabbit hole of John Belushi, I mean, what was that like? Because I mean, obviously, he's not around to interview, so you had to do this from perspectives of everyone who was close to them. What was it like going down that rabbit hole? Because it was, I'm assuming, somewhat scary and hilarious and everything.
Yeah, it was actually a big riddle. You're asking the exact right question because,
thank you.
You know, how do you tell the story? John Belushi, dies of an overdose in the early 1980s. I'm making this film in 2016, 17, 18, whatever. I've lost all track of time and post-COVID, who knows what. But right in the late 20 teens, that's 30 years later, I'm making this. This film, and how do you capture it? How do you capture the rawness? How do you capture? And my objective with this film is to tell the story of. Not of what it was like for John Belushi to die, which is one of the most oft-told stories in entertainment history, but the story of what it was like for John Belushi to live. Mm-hmm. And that's a rarely told story and a story that Judy Belushi and John's family had not granted anybody the opportunity to do since they felt so burned by Bob Woodward when he wrote Wired. So they just shut it down. Well, John Batzik, my dear friend and producing partner on the Belushi film, and had won Judy over and had persuaded her In part because he is such a persuasive, charming man, in part because he spent a decade doing it, in part because he brought me in to direct it, and in part because Judy saw our film Listen to Me, Marlon, which John and I produced and shared it with her. And so she was ready to give us the opportunity to tell this story, but we still had I had the huge riddle of how are we going to bring to the audience what it was like for John Belushi to live all these decades later.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And as I started to do kind of preparatory interviews, talk to people on the phone, have lunch with people who knew John, those kind of things, I was like, everyone's either talking about themselves, as people do, or they're telling the story that they tell about John when they tell stories about John. So they've told this story so many times, and it things felt lost in the foggy haze of memory. They weren't present. They weren't raw. They weren't edgy. And again, if you're going to make a movie about John Belushi, you need raw, present edge. You need to capture the man, and the man was an exposed wire. Well, these conversations I was having were not exposed wire, and I was concerned. And fortunately, when I went to Martha's Vineyard and spent time with my team digging through the archive there, we discovered that in the wake of the Woodward book, Judy and a couple of her friends, including the journalist Tanner Colby, had set out to collect an oral history of John. They didn't know what they would do with it. They knew one day these tapes would come in handy. They did a book that was kind of the tip of the iceberg, but it came and went. And there were these dozens, hundreds of hours of conversations they had had with people in the years immediately following his death. And boom, there was the solution, because, well, you hear it in the film. Mm-hmm. Our ability to capture that was a function of the great gift from the gods and from Judy and Tanner of these interviews.
Yeah, remarkable, absolutely remarkable film. And anybody who—
And incredible people, you know, we're talking about Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd and Lorne Michaels and, you know, on and on and on. And you're hearing from Carrie Fisher, who was kind of John's soulmate in addiction, as well as one of his dearest friends. You're getting into the guts of it all. And we got into the guts of it all. And that film does, you know, it definitely does.
And the family was very happy with the way it came out, from what I understand.
I just spoke to Judy this morning. We were just reminiscing and, you know, expressing our mutual gratitude, and Jim has been great about it. And, you know, he's, I'm sure he'd be the first to tell you he's no easy customer. So his response to the film is very meaningful to us.
That's awesome. Now you are one of those rare documentarians that get the jump in from narrative to documentary, and you are able to go back and forth. How did you transition from documentary to narrative? And was there a little bit of, because I've spoken to other documentarians who have that, and it's always a little bit like, well, yeah, you can tell, but you don't know how to tell. Well, you don't know how to work with actors. You don't know how to tell a story that's a narrative. You just tell these documentary stories. Is that your feeling, or how did you, with If I Stay, how did that project come along? And did you have any issues breaking through to get to be able to make that movie?
Well, once again, remember that I'm a theater director by training. I mean, I spent 20, I started working with actors when I was in first grade.
Sure.
I was directing my fellow first graders, and I studied theater, and I directed plays in college. I was graduated undergraduate from Harvard. And in those days there was no theater department, but we all did plays constantly. We just produced them ourselves, and there were theaters all over campus, and that's what we did. And we were so passionate about it. And, and the teachers who did pass through for the kind of special classes now and then in theater practice or theater drama history or any of the dramatic. I had a constant, my major was dramatic theory and literature, but I had to kind of apply through the special concentration thing. We studied, we were imbued with kind of, you know, the importance of the message, the importance mm-hmm. of the themes, the importance of, you know, making sure that the audience's time was well spent. They, you know, I can't tell you the number of teachers who said to me, you know, you're asking people to come out and spend 2.5 hours sitting in a dark room with you. You better have something important to say. You better know what it is, and you better damn well be entertaining. And I mean, so many people, I was drilled into my head, but so was the importance of how you communicate with your collaborators. Actors, designers, everybody, writers, everybody with whom you're working. So those are things that I personally am trained in. I then, as I said, spent many years directing in the theater. So working with actors is a great joy to me, and sure. And working with designers is a great joy to me, and working with writers is a great joy to me. So it's not new in that way. But it's very different than documentary work. Documentary work is, in a way, documentary work is more like the theater, than film work because you have time in documentary work.
A lot of time.
A lot of time. Yeah. You have time in the theater. You spend weeks and weeks rehearsing and weeks in previews, and you take your time. And I love that in film, you show up on set. And the first thing you hear is somebody yell, "We're losing the light. You're running out of time." You know, it's all day long. You're in a freaking panic. That happens not to be my preferred way of going through a day. I like to chill, and I like to, you know, I like to follow the puck. There's no time to follow the puck. We're making a movie.
You're now, creating the puck. You're creating the puck at that point.
And by the way, maybe in the hands of someone who's more masterful at it than I, it's different, and they know how to. I'm sure that I am certain that Scorsese doesn't feel all day long like he's being rushed. I'm certain of it. But I don't know, man. I got on set. I'm telling you, the first thing you hear is we're losing the light. So, but I did love making that film because I got to work with Chloe Moretz, and I got to adapt the Gale Forman, brilliant Gale Forman book. And I got to, I loved my producer. I loved everybody. And we had a wonderful time, and it was a great experience. And equally rich was the process of creating with Kelly Curry the Nashville, the television series, and directing the first two episodes of that. I mean, the pilot of Nashville is one of the all-time great creative experiences I've ever had, and I'm grateful to all who made it possible. My work with Kelly Curry was just like incredibly. Rich and satisfying, and she created these characters, and she was so brilliant, and they kind of arrived fully formed, and she understood the language and the music and the air, and she's, you know, so that was an incredible honor, and you know, I got to direct Connie Britton. It's just like what a thrill, so many things, and the kids who were in that, the younger actors, the whole Hayden Panettiere, the whole experience, and the music, you know, to be on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry and to work with T-Bone Burnett, on and on. It couldn't have been richer. It couldn't have been more joyful. And, you know, my soul was, and my heart were full with those experiences. Again, the process, I you're right to describe it as going back and forth, because I went there for a little bit, and really these days I'm super focused on my nonfiction work, and it couldn't be richer in terms of, you know, what I'm trying to do with it and the different projects. So it's very exciting, but it's different. You know, we like to say, well, documentary is scripted stuff is documentary backwards, because you do the script before in the narrative, and you do the script in the edit room, and it's kind of that, but there is a lot, the differences are
Just massive.
Massive. And then the similarities are thrilling. It's still cinema.
It's still story.
And to me, these documentaries, I'm not actually interested in the politics of it. I'm not interested in the message. I'm not here to give you facts and information. Google does that far better than any film I could ever. I'm here to tell you a story about the human experience, to spin a yarn, to make great cinema or to aspire to make great cinema, you know, and to engage you and to move you emotionally and to tell you stories about the human condition. Those are my only interest. Others make documentaries for other reasons. They're great documentaries that are kind of, you know, agitprop. There is great theater that's agitprop, as there is great narrative cinema that's agitprop. Not really my thing. My thing is, I'm telling stories about people.
Yeah, very well, might I add. Now, I have to ask you about two subjects that you had in two of your films, who are both very polarizing in their own way, Anna and Dick Cheney. Very different human beings, obviously.
Sure.
From very different walks of life, but both polarizing in their worlds. And regardless of your own beliefs and either political beliefs or anything like that, I know you have to be kind of, you just got to let happen whatever happens. What is it like just juggling, you know? I mean, obviously Dick Cheney, very, very polarizing political figure. And then Anna to a lesser extent, but very polarizing in the world of fashion. How do you approach these two kind of, you know, juggernauts in their space?
Well, your question is in the context of there's an assertion in your question that they're polarizing figures.
Yes.
And I understand why. All politicians, I think, are
polarizing.
You know, especially in this climate. I remember when Colin Powell was flirting with running for president. Mm-hmm. And everyone knew he was flirting with running for president, but nobody knew if he was a Democrat or a Republican. And his numbers were in the 90s. And then he declared that he was a Republican. And boom, his numbers went down to 49% because that's the country we live in. And the Democrats weren't going to support him anymore. And that's, you know. So, of course, the Vice President Cheney is polarizing. And he and I don't, I do not, I, you know, I think he's, I would never pull the switch for him. I would never pull the switch for any of his policies. Mm-hmm. I think he's led us into a war that has been a catastrophe in 70 different ways. Mm-hmm. And I wish he hadn't done it. But I do know that he is as impactful a non-presidential politician as this country has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started pursuing him, he was his heart was in failure. He had a battery in his heart for a heart. You know, some would say he had a block of ice for a heart, but he literally had a battery for a heart. And he was frail when I first met with him. He was weak. He told me in our first meeting that he would look in the mirror and see the ghost of his father. And he knew that his time was coming. And pretty much he was sitting around waiting for one of two things to happen. Either a transplant would be available because he was on a list like everybody else, or he would pass. And he was at peace with that. This is what he told me the day I met him for lunch in his home. By the way, at an address that I couldn't find on Google because Google Maps doesn't have Cheney's address. The next time I met with him, Liz called me. His daughter called me right after he awoke from surgery. It was literally like the day he got out of surgery from the heart transplant. And she said to me, I just want you to know the vice president is doing well. And one of the things he said to us before he went in was that if he survived, he wanted to make sure that making this movie was one of the things that he did this year. So we're ready to go. I mean, it was crazy. It was the day, and I had spent a lot of time waiting for them to say yes or no, and will we do this? And again, human beings want their stories told.
Yeah, I was going
to
say that.
And so I said all this to him when I met him. There was no mystery. I was introduced to him by Mary Madeline, who, of course, I knew through James and through her. We filmed with her on The War Room. She knows my politics. I didn't keep it secret. But my interest wasn't in debating politics. It was in discussing politics. But my interest was in this human, this guy who, you know, flunked out of Yale multiple times and was a drunkard working the lines and hanging electrical lines in Wyoming with no future, but was in love with a woman who said to him, "You won't get it together, man. You're too good for this. Stop drinking." I mean, he was sleeping on the floor of a jail cell because he had been picked up too many times for drunk driving, and they finally threw him in the tank. And his girlfriend, Lynn, I'm sorry not to remember her name, but the woman who would become Lynn Cheney, said, "If you want this relationship to go anywhere, if you want to spend the rest of your life with me, you're going to sober on up and get it together." And he did. He did. He got it together. He changed his life. He went to, you know, he went to graduate school. He was an incredibly brilliant man. He was respected by all of his colleagues in Congress. He was admired in the administration. He was, you know, he played this instrumental role during the first George Bush administration, George H.W., and in the Gulf War. And they were reasonable, and they drew the line. You know, they didn't turn it into a long war. They got in, they got out, they recognized that certain balances of, you know, there was a lot to talk about with him. Then something happened on 9/11 and something, you know, switched. And we tell that story. Yeah. But this is a movie that I think for, you know, I want people to watch this movie 50 years from now. I want them to watch it. I want them to know who this man was, where he came from, what he did, how he did it, how he defends himself. And he had to defend himself in this film. You know, he put duty versus honor. And he said, he dismissed honor as a value in this film. Well, that's a really interesting thing in a person who's leading a country to war. He had to defend torture in this film. That's a really intense thing that someone has to do. And as I say, I think he's the single most impactful non-presidential politician who's ever. I mean, you know, it's no mystery. George W. Bush gave him. Gave him a lot of rope. He had a lot of power in that administration, and he wielded it. And he did some questionable things. I, as a voter, would say some bad things. I, as a filmmaker, left them as questionable so that he could defend them, and you could hear them, and we could be on the record with it. You know, and so that's how I approached that. You know, with Anna, I'm just telling a story about a great, you know, one of the world's great editors, and what does it mean? You know, this bird-like. Little human who also is her father's daughter. You know, that's a big part of it. The great, you know, Charles Wintour, Chili Charles Wintour, the, you know, legendary Fleet Street editor who for 20 years ran the most important paper in England and who was for her very much a role model and someone who she always wanted to please. But she single-handedly, when we were with her, she was single-handedly running this global industry, this multi-billion dollar global industry. And how does she do it? How does she do it? Powerful women are very interesting, fascinating. They tend to be, by the way, they tend to be controversial just because they're women in power.
Of course.
You know, and I'm starting a film now about Martha Stewart. Talk about a person in power who was kind of punished for being in power, you know, for being successful. And there's more to say about it. But you know, look. End of the day, people are fascinating. People, you know, people are remarkable. There's some extraordinary folks out there, and it's they've got great stories to tell. And you know, as you point out, I've had the great good fortune of being able to tell a number of you know, fascinating, certainly, you know, complex people's stories.
Now, your latest project with Billie Eilish, can you tell me a little bit about that film and how that came to be?
I was invited to meet with Billie, and it came to be because I accepted the invitation and I sat with her and Phineas and her folks and some people from her team. And I instantly was engaged, as I'm sure that's no surprise. She's an incredibly magnetic person who's gifted artist and this, you know, incredible young woman. And I saw in that first meeting an opportunity to simultaneously tell the story of a young artist coming of age and coming into her own, and a young woman coming of age and coming into her own. And I loved that. I loved how real it could all be. And that's the film. It's really very simple. You know, then we just followed the puck, and the puck went to some amazing places.
I love that. I love that analogy. It's so wonderful.
Yeah.
But isn't it true? And you've been in rooms with these kind of people. There is an energy to people, especially like to celebrities or artists like that. There's this thing that you can't explain. Like there's this energy that they suck the energy out of the room. Like all the attention goes to them. It's like you can feel when someone like this walks into the room. And I've spoken to many, you know, many people of that magnitude, have been in the room with many people like that on that magnitude. And when you could just be with their back turned and they walk in to the other side of the room and you just go, someone just walked in, and you could just feel that energy. Was that what it was like being with, and it doesn't matter what age it is, by the way, it could be Michael Jackson at 7 years old. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, Billie's a very magnetic personality. There's no question. And as I understand it, she has been her whole life. Her talent, her brilliance, her poetry, her vision are all exceptional. And but she's also this very real kid, you know,
right,
who sits around, you know, making fart jokes and eating burritos and right, wanting to slip out the back door with her boyfriend and, you know, watch porn and whatever, you know, and you know, she's just a kid and who's got the curiosity of a kid and the outrage of a kid and the ambitions and all. And she's made of music. You know, she says her family was one big fucking song. It's true. It's true. And one of the questions I had upon meeting her was, what planet does this person come from? And what planet does Phineas come from? And I certainly, you know, remember thinking and feeling that this is, you know, on some level, she's part human, part deity, you know, and she really is. She's a shaman. You know, she has a power. She stands before hundreds of thousands, and literally on a daily basis, she's on the telephone of 75 million followers, on 80 million followers on Instagram, and she leads. She is a modern day, you know, I don't know what the best way of describing it is,
but it's not deity-like. Yeah, deity. I think deity is a great word.
It is. It's very powerful, and it's shamanistic. It's very, you know, it's all of those things, and you feel it. You feel the power, and she pierces her audience's hearts. She connects with them. They all feel like she's singing directly to them. I've been in tiny rooms with her singing. I've been in enormous rooms with her singing. There's no difference. She can be in an arena in Miami that seats 22,000 people, and the kid in the top bowl of that arena in the back row is connected to Billie Eilish the same way the kid in the front row is, or the kid in the club. It's just amazing. The spaces feel tiny. She has a power, and you see that. You see that in the film.
How? And there's no explanation for it. There's no explanation for that kind of connection.
Well, I don't want to say there's no explanation. I just want to say, you know, those who explain those, that's not my business. Explain it. It's my business to show it and to tell the story about it.
Sure.
And others can explain it. But I think the film is, you know, certainly reveals the power. I mean, it's a lot of, and there are a lot of things involved. Let's talk about the fact that First of all, she's not an only child prodigy. She's one of two prodigies in that same house. And they need each other. They make each other even greater than either, you know, she and Phineas. They are a partnership. So when I say what planet do they come from, on some level, the answer is, you know, planet Maggie's womb, that where they both spent 9 years, 9 months gestating to the same heartbeat. And then they were raised by the same parents, and you see all the complete, and they were raised in a particular way, which, as Billy says in the film, you know, first and foremost, they were encouraged to be themselves. And first and foremost, their family was one big fucking song, as she says in the film. You know, those two lines I just quoted are pretty much the first line in the film and the last line in the film. So the whole film is about how those things come together. But there are lots of explanations, and then some things are just can't be explained, can they?
It's that thing that is, you know it when you see it, but you just can't articulate.
Well, you know,
but Jim Belushi, John Belushi,
you know,
all this.
Life's, you know, again, this is my, you know, I have a lot of gratitude because I'm able to tell these stories, and these stories kind of live in the landscape of people are just, you know, fascinating. And there are so many remarkable people doing these incredible things. And, you know, I'm not kidding when I say it's dust in the wind. We're all here for a blip. Listen, Billy is nothing if not an existentialist, and raised by Patrick, who is nothing if not an existentialist, as we see in the film. And she's like, you know, I remember early on her being interviewed, and somebody was like, why do you do it all your way? Don't you think you'd have even more success if you conform? And she's like, well, why would I do anything that I don't believe in? Like, I'm gonna live. I'm gonna die. Y'all are gonna forget I was ever here. Why would I bother with doing anything that wasn't true to myself? What's the point? None of it matters. It's like songs that are gonna come, and then one day no one will even know I was here. And why wouldn't I have spent my time here? This is a child talking.
I was gonna say the wisdom.
Why wouldn't I spend my time being true to myself? And that's her whole thing. That is the whole Billie Eilish thing. Be true to yourself in the way you work. Be true to yourself in the way you treat others. Be true to yourself in the art that you put out in the world. Be true to yourself in the way you dress. Be true to yourself. Be yourself. That's, you know, that's might be considered a kind of radical philosophical approach, but right? It's hers, and it resonates the world over through her art and just her persona.
And where can you people watch this film?
The World According to I'm sorry, the World According to Billie Eilish, it could be called. Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry is on Apple TV Plus. There's another series we have on Apple called Dear, which is a wonderful project that we did about how work impacts people. And then on Showtime is the John Belushi film called Belushi. And we talked a lot in this conversation about The War Room. That's available on Criterion. Yes. And of course, all these films, you know, they're all on a streaming service. And what a pleasure to chat about it all with you.
And can I ask you a last few questions I always ask all my guests? Yeah. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Make a movie.
Best movie. Best advice.
No, please don't go to film school. Please make a movie. Film school is an old paradigm that provided for equipment. And that's it. It provided for equipment. It gave you access to equipment you couldn't afford. You couldn't afford a camera when it was a film camera.
Or Steam Deck.
Processing. You couldn't afford. Now, guess what? Here's a camera. Here's a camera. This I'm holding up a telephone. Here's a camera, the new iPhone. It's got an editing equipment on it that does the trick. You can upgrade, but you got it all. Or buy a camera from Amazon and return it in 29 days. It's not illegal. It's their policy. It's how they became the biggest company on the planet. And Jeff Bezos became one of the richest men to ever have lived. He's a pharaoh. And he says, please buy stuff from me. make a movie and return it 29 days later, and I'll give you your money back. I'll pay for your film. That's what Jeff Bezos says. He does. He says it. So that's what my advice to young filmmakers. Don't talk about agents. Don't talk about showbiz. Don't talk about film school. Don't just make a movie. And guess what? It may suck. Then make another movie. It's going to be better than the first one. And that is absolutely my advice. Carry on, man. Tell stories with your friends.
Amen. Preach, my friend, preach. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oh, goodness. I hesitate because the lesson that took me the longest to learn is one I'm sure I'm still learning.
Sure.
But you know, I think it's all going to be all right. It's all going to be fine is a good lesson. You know, I mentioned that I was James Lapine's assistant on Into the Woods, the Broadway musical, mm-hmm. the legendary Lapine-Sondheim musical that I think it was 1987 or 88 that we did it. And I remember one night James saying to me, you know, the biggest part of my job, you know what the biggest part of my job is? And I was like, what? He said, just saying to everybody, it's all going to be great. It's all going to be great. And I was like, oh shit, that is, you say that all the time. I was like, that's the biggest part of my job. It's all going to be great. It's all going to be great. So, you know, I say that's a lesson that's worth remembering, mm-hmm. you know, and so there you go.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh my goodness. The Lady Eve.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great.
Preston Sturges film.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just leave it at the.
Oh,
yeah. Here we go. Give Me Shelter. Mm-hmm. Alan David Maisel's mm-hmm. film about the Rolling Stones.
Amazing.
At Altamont.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. And I'll put on this list. Don't Look Back. D.A. Pennebaker's masterpiece about Bob Dylan.
Fantastic. RJ, it has been a pleasure talking shop with you today, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it, my friend.
Likewise. Really, really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank RJ for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, RJ. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry on Apple TV, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/478. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, leave a good review and subscribe. It really helps the show out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.